Okay, welcome to Menschmaking. We're back March 10th. Thank you to Radio Laurier for hosting this wonderful program. We get a chance to talk about Jewish values to help make you a better person. Today's topic is not such a cheery topic. So, although it's not a very happy topic, I think it's an important topic. So, before we do dive into this not so happy topic, I'd like to play a song for you that is a more happy song. So, have a little bit of balance, some happiness, and some seriousness. The song is called Ivdu, and it's a song about always being happy, maintaining a happy, positive outlook on life, serving God with joy, bringing lots of joy to everything that you do. Here it goes. And that is that. We're back. So the heavy, not so happy topic that we're going to be addressing today is the topic of anti-Semitism, the age-old discrimination, bigotry, hatred of the Jewish people. It's an old, old story. It's been around pretty much as long as there have been Jews around. And so we want to take a stab at this and see if we can maybe understand and unpack a little bit of what we think, where it comes from, and where it's going, how it affects the Jewish people, how it affects society at large, what we can all do about it, how to deal with it.
Yeah.
So, Bobby, tell me, what are your thoughts on this whole issue? Where do you see this coming from? What's it all about?
Well, I am anti-Semitism.
I would hope so.
But, you know, I don't know. We were talking about it earlier. What does it mean, anti-Semitism? And I think it comes from a lot of levels, but ultimately, it comes from fear. Mm-hmm. And not in the scared of this like power, but scared of something that isn't, that people are not really aware of, that people don't really know so well.
Right, like the unknown.
The unknown, right? Because how many people, like, I mean, if you don't live in Thornhill, right, you've never really, you really have much contact with Jews, right?
So you're saying that anti-Semitism would be more prevalent in places where there are less Jews. And if there's more Jews and people are better exposed to Jews, and they know more about the Jewish religion and Jewish culture and Jewish community, and they actually know individual Jews as friends, there would be less anti-Semitism?
I mean, I think totally. Like, one time I was heading back from yeshiva, from my, you know, from school in Pittsburgh, coming home to Toronto, and I was praying on the bus, and this lady came up to me, and she touched my forehead and asked me if I was Jewish and where my horns were.
Oh, come on.
Right? This is a for real story. This is, yeah.
For reals?
And I was taken aback because I was like, what the frick, lady, get your hands off me. This is so weird. Right? But this was like to no fault of her own. She was just, she's never met a Jew before. And she was raised with this idea that all Jews had horns.
Oh, come on. That's unreal.
Right?
How long ago
and
was this?
And this was when I was in grade 9. So I was right, 14 years old. Small little yeshiva.
About 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Not 15.
Not 15, 10.
Yeah.
10 years ago.
Still, right. Recent enough to be ridiculous.
And no, but it's crazy. But the thing is, it wasn't malicious, right?
No.
And I can see where that can become malicious, where people are told these lies, right? And they've never had anything to counter that.
Right. Well, generally, when it's told deliberately, maliciously, it's told in order to find a scapegoat, find someone to blame for whatever problem's going on. That's historically been like motivation number one. Like, why the Jews? Well, we need somebody to blame. So the Jews. The Jews have always been outsiders. By definition, our way of life, our culture, our religion is so different, is so distinct from any other community and any other nation that we've ever lived in. That as long as we stuck to that, we've been seen as different. It's an impossible thing to both be completely invested in the Jewish culture and religion, observant of it, practicing it, and not be distinguishable from other members of society that aren't Jewish. It's almost like a seesaw. To the degree that you're indistinguishable, to the degree that your schedule of work, your manner of eating, your ways of marriage, to the degree that those are not different than anyone else around you, to that degree, you're not actively practicing Judaism, and vice versa. So anywhere there's been Jewish practice, we've always been different. We live a different way. And that sets you up, first of all, that sets you up for, you know, ripe for the picking. But not that that's the reason for it, and that somehow if that goes away, history has already proven that, you know, anti-Semitism will flourish regardless of the level of observance of the Jewish people. There's lots of, you know, I mean, the Holocaust is the biggest, most recent example. But it's not only about the Jews being distinctly Jewish. Somehow they find this. But back to my original point, it is a sort of way for people, for leaders in politics or in business, mostly in politics, to find a scapegoat for the problems. And they latch on to maybe one example. This is what bugs me. Like, you might find one example of an individual Jewish person doing something, or even a group of Jewish people doing something. But somehow the entire Jewish nation is to blame, and somehow every Jew in the world is to blame, and it's everybody's fault, and therefore all Jews are just as terrible as this one person or group of people that you found doing something wrong that are Jewish. It's got nothing to do with anything.
Oh, for sure, right? And this is because we were talking that it has been rising, you know, throughout the past few years, right? That anti-Semitism has been on the rise, and you know, so has this idea of playing identity politics, right? Just grouping people together based on their group membership,
right?
Right, and
just painting with a broad brush. It's got nothing. There's no wisdom in such an approach. There's really no wisdom in painting with such a broad brush. You know, you would never say, you know, there was a white guy who robbed a convenience store, so therefore, obviously, white people are dangerous. You'd never say such a thing. Well, I mean, white people wouldn't say such a thing. But somehow, when it comes to minorities, it becomes logical and morally okay for people to say, let's paint the whole group with that brush. What?
I'm just thinking that it's like this is descriptive and it's true, right? It's like I'm just trying to think. Something that comes into my head now is my dad always told me he grew up in the Soviet Union, right? And he was very interestingly kind of thankful for anti-Semitism, and this is a weird idea, right? And for him, it was because, like, here in today's society, where everyone is kind of supposed to be accepting of one another, right? We have like this multicultural mosaic where everyone's like, you know, the same in their difference, right? He's like, this kind of takes you away from the role that you need to play. It makes you feel okay by not like some being, I don't know, like a Jewish
person. If you're being accepted,
yes.
If you were to be fully accepted for who you are, that would be kind of a problem in a way.
Yeah. So for him, and if this was with regard to specifically assimilation of Jews, he's saying with anti-Semitism in Russia, this reminded you consistently that this is who you are, right? And you have to like be held to some sort of moral code of your own group.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're representative of that group, then you have to be the best person that you can be,
mm-hmm.
because people are always staring at you and watching you.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there's an upside to it, but I mean, all around the
board. It's a silver lining, sure. It's a silver lining. I mean, I don't think we need anti-Semitism. I don't think any minority, zoom out for a second, I don't think any minority needs persecution in order to maintain its identity. There are other ways of maintaining identity. Although, in all honesty, the flip side, when your group is persecuted, it definitely reinforces your identity in a very strong, visceral way. And it's hard to shake. You know exactly who you are because you've just been, you know, pushed down and called names or whatever, or you know, being discriminated from your career opportunities or whatever, you know, no Jews allowed, whatever.
Yeah.
It definitely hammers home, look, I know exactly who I am. I have a clear identity. I am Jewish. I can't forget it. Society doesn't let me forget it, even if I might try. I think another thing that drives anti-Semitism is that the people... You know, the people who engage in anti-Semitism and resist the implication that they are anti-Semites. You know, some people say, yeah, I hate Jews, you know, flat out. I'm a hate-filled person. I hate Jews. I'm an anti-Semite. Call me whatever you want. There are others who will engage in some form of anti-Semitism, some form of anti-Semitic rhetoric. And then when you call them on it, they'll say, this is not, I don't hate Jews, right? I'm not a hate-filled person. I mean, I'm calling it how I see it. Is that a problem? I'm just doing some honest criticism. Is that a problem? Are Jews, you know, immune from being criticized? Can I never call out a problem if I see a problem? And sometimes they're right. And I think there are times when the Jewish community has a little bit of a anxiety attack And justifiably so. But it's driven a lot, it's very driven by emotion and anxiety rather than, you know, sober analysis of the facts. Whenever somebody does engage in some criticism, we're very quick to say, you know, that's anti-Semitism. We're very quick to say it's discrimination. And understandably so, because we have a long history, and it's like throwing a match into a bucket of kerosene. Of course it's going to blow up. Like, you can't tell the kerosene, calm down. It was just a little match. Yes, but you have to understand the context. And a microaggression in the context of 1,000 years of history of persecution is enough to start a fire.
Well, the thing is, these things are a bit more than microaggressions. I feel like, well, like...
I'm saying even a microaggression, even something small that really objectively, logically isn't a big deal can spark people into feeling, you know, that they're being hunted again.
That's true, but do you think that's the correct response, then?
Again, correct response logically is one thing. Correct response in the context of your history and your culture and what you've been through, you know, you don't tell the person who's clinically depressed, cheer up. Come on, what's the big deal? Cheer up. Logically, it's not a big deal. But in the context of clinical depression, it is a big deal, right? So the same thing here. I think that there are things that logically aren't a big deal. But just there's such a history, and it's so packed into your identity as a Jew, that when there's a slightest hint of discrimination, you immediately revert into survival mode, and you fear for your life, and you fear for your safety, and you say this is anti-Semitic bigotry.
It's
tricky. In other words, it is a tricky thing to navigate. But the point is back to the person, right? So I'm talking about this prototypical person who doesn't believe they're full of hatred. They actually believe they're speaking truth to power. They think the Jews have all the power. The Jews are in all these... And it's true. You do see Jews in powerful positions in business, in politics, in technology, in media. There are Jews in positions of power. The problem is we're not nearly as coordinated as the anti-Semites would like you to believe. Anyway, it's not like we all get together once a year and plan our agenda for the year.
You didn't get your check this week. Did you get your check?
Don't say checks. Bobby, on the radio. You can't say that now.
I'm saying, like, I would like to get paid for this global conspiracy. I'm just saying.
Right. No, but that's the thing. Like, you see, I think people who aren't familiar with the Jewish community, they don't know how things work. They see, you know, there's a Rosenberg here. There's a Klein there. There's a Schwartz over there. And these aren't German names in these cases. They're Jewish names in these cases. And they say, well, this Jewish guy is ahead of that bank. This Jewish guy is ahead of that newspaper. Clearly, the Jews run the world. Except that they hate each other. They don't agree with each other. They don't talk to each other. And they disagree on every point. So there can't be a conspiracy because they're not in cahoots with each other. There just happen to be Jewish people who are successful in their careers. There are, thank God, there are a lot of those examples. But it falls apart if you understand that there's no coordinated effort in any way between all these entities. I mean, you don't have no idea how much replication of effort there is in the Jewish community to accomplish certain mutual goals. Everybody's got their own nonprofit organization to get the same goal done, because everybody's got a slightly different angle and can't possibly work together with the other guy. Like, there's so much diversity of opinion in the Jewish community. The thought of us getting together and having some kind of massive conspiracy to work it all out together and cooperate, I mean, it's a nice utopian dream, but it's a joke.
Yeah. Jews, what's that old adage? Two Jews, three opinions?
At least three opinions, at the very least. And since opinions don't cost much, it might be four. It's like, it's a joke to hear people say that. But I can see where they're coming from. I can see how people might think that. But it's just ignorance.
So then would you agree that it comes from this place of not knowing, right? Being scared of what you don't know, right?
Absolutely. In I'm talking about in those cases where you don't have a person full of, you know, malicious hatred. Person who considers himself a decent person tries to do the right thing and is calling out, you know, something wrong when they see something wrong. You can call out something wrong without ever going near the guy's Jewish identity. You know, if someone's a bona fide criminal, he's a bona fide criminal. We're all fellow human beings. Some of us human beings are criminals. And here, you've met one of them. He should be dealt with the full, you know, extent of whatever justice system in his country. Great. Why does his Jewish identity have to come into it? Why do you have to invoke these tropes, you know, these libelous, broad, vague images?
You know, oftentimes people have these ideas, right? And I remember learning this in social psychology, where it's like the self-fulfilling prophecy, where people have these ideas about, or these opinions about a certain group, right? And let's say there's 20 examples of disconfirming evidence. And then there's maybe 2 examples of confirming evidence that fits the stereotype, right? The two examples are a bit more salient in that person's mind. So then they'll be like, that's it, right? Like, because they're looking for it.
Right. Confirmation bias.
Confirmation bias, exactly.
And so on and so forth. There are a lot of psychological tricks. And I think it's great to read up on a lot of the recent studies in psychology that prove how irrational we are and how our decisions and our thought making, our thought processes and our decision making are so driven by subconscious bias, by emotion, by fear, by everything but pure logic and the sincere search for truth. That would help in general, especially when it comes to this. But I want to, if we can, I want to swing to address, you know, the flip side of anti-Semitism, which is the Semites, the Jews, the different reactions that Jewish people have to anti-Semitism, and the various options that you have as a Jew for dealing with anti-Semitism. Like, what are the reactions? What are the possible responses you might have as a Jew to anti-Semitism, and what's you know, the alternatives that you might not have thought of? So let's start first with, you know, what are some of the common reactions that, you know, in your typical Jewish community, whenever there's, let's just take a bona fide case of anti-Semitism. Okay, someone sprays paints a swastika on the side of a synagogue.
Well, you have the Jewish Federation going crazy, right? Taking out all sorts of newspaper ads, the B'nai B'rith, right? Everyone's pretty scared, right? This is like, I guess it reminds people of the Holocaust or, you know, something like that, God forbid, right?
Right.
And people just take this visceral, have this visceral reaction of like, let's nip it in the butt immediately as possible. Like, these people need to, you know, go away forever type of thing. And I feel like, do you feel like that's maybe overblown?
I mean, again, I think that it's understandable. I don't fault people for feeling that way. My personal experience has been a little bit different. Look, I grew up in a great Jewish community in Brooklyn, New York. I never experienced anti-Semitism as a kid. My neighborhood was not a segregated neighborhood that was full of only Jews by any means. It was a very integrated neighborhood where just on my block and on either side of my house, we had families that came from the Caribbean. Black families from various islands, Haiti, Guyana, Jamaica, and that was the makeup of the neighborhood was, you know, I don't know, 50-60% Chabad Orthodox Jews, and then 40-50% Caribbean American Black families. We got along for the most part. We didn't, weren't necessarily best friends, but we had no issues. There was no persecution on either side. Except, you know, we did have the riots in 1991. That was a flare-up. Long story, not for now. But for the most part, before and after, in the community itself, no anti-Semitic... There wasn't a lot of anti-Semitism. There's crime, general crime, like any big city. But nothing overtly anti-Semitic when I was growing up. So that colored my opinion of the world, you know, in a very strong way. I grew up, I had a great childhood. I had a great, very peaceful childhood. And it continued through high school and all that. Until today, I'm really not, I don't believe, you know, the world is full of anti-Semites. I think there are some out there for sure. I think we have to be vigilant, can't be foolish. And there are some disturbing trends that are occurring lately in Europe and North America. But, you know, I think a lot of it is also that we live in a world where we hear about everything. And it's not that the world is so much worse off than it was before. You know, we hear about everything, we pay attention to everything. We scrutinize everything. And some things can be ignored. Some things need to be addressed. And even when you address it, you know, I'm very skeptical of preaching to the choir. You know, all the good-minded folks in the world, in the neighborhood, get together and condemn the anti-Semitism. That's great. But we are the people that don't think that way. We need to find and address and confront the people who have a little bit of a tolerance for anti-Semitism, have a little bit of a you know, a comfort level with picking fun at the, making fun of the Jews, or throwing out comments like, oh, don't let him Jew you down, right? Those are the people that need to be educated. They have to be exposed to other Jewish people. They have to realize the impact of their words, of their attitudes. I don't see a whole lot of that going on. I'd love to see more of that. You know, I'd love to see a program or a nonprofit deal with somehow, I don't know exactly how, but that to me, that's the only thing worth working towards. The rest is like, eh.
Yeah, I mean, like, what comes to mind to me, I didn't watch the video itself, but I read the headline of the video, so I guess, you know. But it was this black individual who would go confront KKK members,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he would
right,
change their mind.
Right.
Right? He was like, well, what do you think of me?
Right.
And by having some sort of discourse, right? He's like, look, I'm a person, you're a person, let's talk about this stuff.
Right, right. So to me, that's golden. That's the goal, that's the point. That would be such a great use of our resources. Instead, we have a lot of organizations that claim to be fighting anti-Semitism, and what they do really is just, you know, make a lot of noise. They complain to the authorities. They're not finding the people full of hate and confronting them and educating them.
Well, yeah, that's why I don't think it's up to the organizations to do it. I think it's up to every single individual to do it, right?
Right.
It's like our job to be like, look, guys, this is who I am. Like, make some noise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm Jewish. I'm proud of being Jewish, and I'm not this monster who lives in the ether and controls everything, right? I can barely control my own schedule.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean?
Right. If I can control myself from going down a YouTube rabbit hole, that'd be great.
That's the struggle.
Get some, like, let me get some world, you know, world Jewish power to control me from going down a YouTube rabbit hole. That'd be nice.
And so I feel like that, I don't know, I want to hear your opinion. Do you think that maybe that's a good idea?
I think it would be great. I think, sure, ultimately that's what you need. Like any program of changing, you know, hearts and minds, it's the people, it's grassroots. It's not, you know, top down. Look, there are things we can do. I think that the program that exists in many communities of having high school students be meet with Holocaust survivors is a great example. I think that's something that's really useful, because not that they're all necessarily full of hate, but this is you're catching people at an age where they're developing their opinions of the world, young enough to listen, young enough to still be, you know, have an impression made on them. I think that's a great example of a useful, productive educational tool that we can do and deploy relatively easily, relatively cost effectively. You know, it just takes some cooperation between the school boards and some organization to coordinate those encounters. I think there's a lot of value in that.
I think that's phenomenal. I remember I was watching this white supremacist. He used to be a white supremacist, now he's recovered. But he had a music shop where he would sell like white power music, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he also had to sell some other CDs so people wouldn't, you know,
right,
call the cops on him, right?
Right.
And one day he saw this black dude very upset, and he hated black people because he's a white supremacist. But he's like, well, let me ask him, what's wrong, buddy? And he said, my mother has cancer. And then that got him thinking, because he's like, well, my mother also has cancer.
Wow.
And that type of human link, that
sure.
humanity really brought him to like what's the what really is the difference between us?
Sure. Exactly.
Right, appealing. So I feel like appealing to the human side, like, look, guys,
of
like,
course.
We're on the same team,
yes.
human team.
Yes,
same
absolutely.
Planet.
No, it's true. We're all, look, one of the reasons, let's throw in a Jewish teaching here. The Talmud says that one of the reasons that Adam was created as a single person, in other words, God didn't create the human race, he created the human being, as opposed to other forms of life, he created a bunch of them at once. So the point of having creation start with one human being is to say that every single human being that will ever be born throughout history has a common grandfather and a common grandmother. We're essentially all cousins, just, you know, times 100.
Yeah.
The point being, no one should ever be able to say, I am, you know, objectively a better type of human being than you are. It's physically impossible, because we all have the same grandma and grandpa. So how could you objectively be a better human being than I am? You can't. It's logically, scientifically impossible. Of course, based on the Bible.
But like, yeah, we're all part
of
the system,
that idea.
Right?
Absolutely. You know, whenever I see, like, I have a lot of professional contacts, and you have a relationship with them that's professional. But if you ever see them like in a family photo with their spouse and the kid or their parents, it adds a whole nother angle to the relationship. You know, you see a person's LinkedIn picture, that's, you know, very nice. You went and got headshots and you're looking all spiffy. But a family photo, like, dude, we're the same. You also had a barbecue in your backyard with your family. That's great. Yeah. I can relate to that. You know, I can see myself there. You can see yourself at my backyard having a barbecue. These kinds of, you know, these moments of humanity really ought to show us that we're not that different. We can have our differences. They're minor, relatively. I'm not saying we all have to be the same. I'm not saying, you know, sing John Lennon song, Imagine, and eliminate all religion and everything that makes us different and unique. That's not what I'm saying. You can have all the religion and culture in the world, but it doesn't have to translate to, therefore, we are too different to get along. We are too different to coexist. We can't have a conversation. I can even criticize you, but the criticism has to be built on a relationship. You don't walk in, you'll never make a friend by walking in and saying, hi, your clothes don't match. And in the same,
that's why I have no friends.
At the same level, I think, you know, cosmically and globally, we have to have relationships of respect and maybe even love. Tolerance is a dirty word. I don't aim for tolerance. There's a reason there aren't any cards in the gift shop that say, I tolerate you. It's not a good emotion to strive for. We want respect at the very least. Love would be even nicer. And it's not that hard to have a basic respect for every human being until they do something to unearn your respect. It's really not that hard. I think it needs to be the baseline for everything. And finally, I think in terms of the reaction of the Jewish people, the reaction of the Semites to anti-Semitism, I think it's so important that I'm speaking now to the Jewish people, that you don't allow a hater to define you. You don't allow a hater to move you from being who you are. It's the worst thing to do, and it's not going to help anything. You have to be proud in who you are. You have to be strong in who you are. There's strength in numbers. To join up with other people and to connect, to be part of a community, strengthens your resolve, strengthens your Jewish identity, allows you to feel safer, less fearful for your safety. There's tremendous comfort and strength in numbers. And we can't have a situation where, because there's some anti-Semitism in the world, the Jews go underground. If anything, it should be the opposite. You have to prove to the anti-Semite that the hatred and the discrimination and the bigotry and the name-calling and all that has exactly the opposite effect. They're hoping to drive you underground. They're hoping to weaken you by demonstrating that you're even more committed and even more serious about your life as a Jew, about doing a mitzvah, about observing Jewish holidays, and so on. You literally, by doing so, you literally pull the rug out of the, you know, from under the anti-Semite's feet. There's nothing left to stand on. He's been completely ineffective. He's been actually counterproductive in his agenda. I think it's very important that we send that message out. And whenever there's a case of anti-Semitism, we don't need committees and task forces and investigations as much as we need Jews to become stronger. Ben Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, said, it matters not what the nations say, it matters what the Jews do. To me, that's so true. And so whenever there's a case of anti-Semitism, and the reason we're talking about this now is, besides for the general trends that are, you know, unfortunately rising in society to some degree, we're also coming up on the holiday of Purim, which is going to be, this year is on Wednesday, March 20th at night, and Thursday, March 21st. And there's going to be a Purim celebration at Chainsaw on Wednesday, March 20th, starting at 9 p.m. And it's very important that we celebrate this holiday, because this holiday is all about responding to anti-Semitism in the most positive, constructive way, full of faith and optimism, not getting into a shouting match with your opponent, doing what you need to stay safe, but most of all, maintaining and developing and enhancing your strong Jewish identity. Now, we have a special guest with us here in the studio today. My son Mendel is here. And to touch on Purim for a moment, I want to ask you, Mendel, tell us, what is your, what's the most exciting part of Purim for you, and what's the message of Purim that you take?
I'll start with the message from Purim first. Okay. If that's okay. a message of Purim is that no matter where you are, where you're from, like what type of Sephardic, Ashkenazic, etc., and if there's like any anti-Semite subject coming up, should try to fight it and like not get disturbed by it, that it like disturbs you from what you're doing in the world.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see that in the story of Purim? Is that something you take from the actual story of Purim?
I think in the Purim story, after Haman got permission from the king to write the decree to kill the Jews, Mordechai, the leader in Shushan at the time, gathered all the children, 22,000 children, and learned Torah with them. Mm-hmm. And it was all because of the children that Haman was punished instead of the Jews.
There you go.
So it's the power of the children that help get rid of anti-Semitism.
Excellent. That's a great lesson. Okay, I think we're out of time. So we're going to wrap it up here by saying thank you for tuning in. I think we still have more to talk about on this topic. We might keep it going for the next year or two. But we will do, I think, another episode or two on this topic. There's a lot more to talk about. We haven't really uncovered everything. So thank you for tuning in. Thank you again to Radio Laurier. And until the next time, please do all you can to talk to the people in your circle of influence. Whenever you see somebody being anti-Semitic, racist, or homophobic, or whatever form of bigotry and hatred you might encounter, don't be afraid to speak up. Don't be afraid to make a comment like, dude, that's not okay. Come on, what are you saying? And try to encourage people to see all fellow human beings as, you know, long-lost cousins. And we don't have to agree on everything. There's a way to criticize. There's a method that's effective. Raging and contempt usually does not lead to great results. Even if you have a good reason to be angry, it's just not effective. It puts everybody's defenses up, and we just get into more conflict. So let's try to find a better way forward. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time.